This show is produced by the Hartman Media Company. For more information and links to all our great podcasts, visit hartmanmedia.com.
Welcome to The Commercial Investing Show, where we analyze, explain, and exploit the opportunities presented in today's commercial property marketplace. If you're interested in apartments, mobile home parks, self-storage facilities, and other income property, you've come to the right place. We'll explore what's hot and what's not in markets nationwide in the relentless pursuit of return on investment. Here's your host, Jason Hartman.
It's my pleasure to welcome Hunter Thompson to the show. He is an innovative guy, a full-time real estate investor, and founder of Cashflow Connections. They are a private equity firm based out of Los Angeles. Since he started CFC, Hunter has helped investors allocate capital to over 100 properties, which have a combined asset value of $350 million. In connection with these investments, he has worked with some of the most experienced and well-respected asset teams in the U.S. and Canada as well. Can't wait to hear his story today as we mostly talk about self-storage, that being our focus today. Hunter, welcome. How are you?
Really great. And thanks again for having me on. It's an honor to be on the program.
It's a pleasure. So Hunter, how did you get started in, I guess, the real estate business broadly? You do mobile home parks and self-storage. It sounds like those two are really your focus. Just give us a little background.
Yeah, sure. So, you know, I have a kind of an interesting story, and it's interesting. I haven't really actually talked about it. I've talked about it once before, but I just recently kind of got the okay to discuss the story, and I think you'll understand why in just a moment. So my grandfather was a successful businessman in the late 80s and had a international cotton business that was very successful. They had $100 million of revenue in 1987, $100 million plus in 1988, and he was a major market mover. And so, you know, when he made calls, people would listen, kind of similarly to the way that the major market movers of today, the Warren Buffetts, the Carl Icahns, make calls and the entire market listens. Well, in 1989, he saw something in the market that he anticipated would result in a shortage of cotton that would result in just massive price inflation. And in order to take advantage of this, he leveraged about 10 to 1, took out a significant amount of debt, and the shortage happened. But for some reason, the price increase that he anticipated just did not take place at all. And because of how over-leveraged he was, the bank got really scared, kind of similar to what happened in 2008. They completely shut off the access to debt after decades of relationship and just really stopped the business in its foot. Bankruptcy, personal bankruptcy, completely shut everything down and, you know, resulted in absolute financial catastrophe. Just to clarify this, you know, we hear a lot of stories right now about Bitcoin and even the dot-com bubble where people would experience massive wealth and then 3 months later it's gone. Well, that's not exactly what this was. This was decades of performance to zero. And to add insult to injury, when these bankruptcy proceedings were taking place, the increase in the prices that he predicted happened. And so all the people that were listening to his picks that were going along with him, they made a significant amount of money just by mimicking his movements. And so why this really matters.
But he probably couldn't do those movements himself.
Oh, no. Right. Oh, no. I mean, it was just, you know, complete catastrophe had just taken place. And then he was just completely eliminated from the marketplace while his friends were emailing him saying, or I guess not emailing him at the time, but messaging him and saying, you know, thank you so much. You know, we just completely benefited from your call. And so part of this is why I'm so passionate about this sector is because I really like helping people avoid those type of calamities. I think it's important to take away, you know, diversification is absolutely key, regardless of what kind of advantage you have over your marketplace, which he certainly had an advantage. And taking aggressive leverage, particularly in a volatile asset class like a commodity, eventually that's going to result in principal loss. You know, look at people like Ike Batista. You know, they had a net worth of $30 billion and it went negative in about 18 months. So I really, that's why I was so excited to share this story. And that's why I really love the business I'm in, because if you just take a small percentage of that and invest it conservatively over the type of investments that you and I both invest in, that can create generational wealth.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm not complaining at all.
Income property is the most historically proven asset class in the world, no question. Yeah.
Exactly.
Absolutely.
Again, I'm not complaining. I think that the story taught me more than any amount of money could possibly teach me. And so, but apparently, you know, it's easy for your listeners to hear this story well and learn from it rather than experience it themselves. So that's why I'm so excited about it, you know, to talk about it and passionate sure. about what I do as well.
Okay. So why self-storage though? Let's talk about the sort of macro investment strategy there.
Yeah. So I think that generally speaking, all types of real estate do well when the economy is booming and the capital markets are loose. And I think that it's important to look at some of the asset classes that where the demand is essentially inversely correlated with the overall economy. And there's a lot of reasons for this. I mean, there's a lot of negative economic data points coming out there. You know, the cycle has been incredibly long. We've had a basically 10 years of a run up or so, depending on what metrics you look at. And there's a lot of reasons that the demand for the product of self-storage is really tied to recessions. So you think about why people use the product. They're usually going through some kind of life change. And a lot of those changes can be brought on by economic downturns. So you're talking about, you know, job changes, people getting their house foreclosed on, kids moving home from college unexpectedly. All of these are more common during recessions. And all of these are reasons why people use the self-storage product. And I think that it really helps balance out your portfolio when you have a product that is inversely correlated with the overall economy.
Okay, so it's inversely correlated. I'm kind of going to assume your thesis here is that people move down during bad times and they don't get rid of all their stuff and they've got to put it somewhere. Is that the thesis?
Exactly. So you're seeing a lot of downsizing taking place, particularly in baby boomer generation, where, you know, they're relying on Social Security. The average Social Security check is about $1,300 a month. The average two-bedroom apartment rents for about $1,300 a month in the U.S. So it's just financially speaking, it's a mathematical equation. It cannot take place. So you're seeing a lot of downsizing, which is creating a lot of opportunity in markets like Florida, et cetera. And you kind of compound this with the fact that the tenants aren't as price sensitive to rental increases because the gross dollars is just really not that significant. So you have, let's say, in multifamily, you have 3 to 4 rental increases on a regular basis. Well, with self-storage, you know, if you're renting a 10 by 10 unit, which is kind of the standard of the industry, if you raise rents by 6%, that's only $6 a month. So the question then becomes, why would the tenant, you know, take the day off work, get a rental truck, hire movers, and move down the street where they're probably going to do the same thing only for $6 a month? And overwhelmingly, we've found that that is not the case. They will not do that. So you can be really aggressive with rental increases. You have this really interesting combination of this, you know, supply-demand disequilibrium and a really sticky tenant base that's not subject to a lot of those, those
price changes. I agree with you that the tenant base is fairly sticky, and I notice my own behavior with storage units and how every month when I see that on my credit card bills, I just think, what a ripoff this is. They just keep raising my rent, and, you know, it's unbelievable. But the tenants may be sticky. That there's some truth to that for sure. But the ability to create new supply is not really that difficult. I mean, many self-storage facilities are like erector sets. They can go up in a very, very short time. I mean, some of the construction lead on these is incredibly fast. But,
right.
You know, of course, it does require land. It depends on the building style. If it's urban, it's got to be, you know, multi-story, et cetera, et cetera. But maybe you want to speak to that.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. It's definitely a really important piece of the underwriting process. So kind of as a rule of thumb, we look for markets where there's a significant supply-demand disequilibrium. And one way to kind of pinpoint that, not the only way, but one way, is we have a national average of about 7.6 square feet per person in the U.S., and that's kind of market dependent. But generally speaking, if we look at a market and we can find that there is a 5-mile radius around our subject property where there is significantly less than 7 square feet per person of self-storage, there's a significant supply-demand disequilibrium. Now, there's other metrics that we want to look at, income in the area, daily traveled vehicles, et cetera, but that's a really good starting point.
Okay, so the typical American uses 7.5 feet of storage space. On average, right?
Exactly.
Is that
yes.
adult and American or all Americans?
That's all Americans. So that's a population. And so when you have a 5-mile radius that is, let's say, 250,000 square feet undersupplied, to your point, it can be very easy to erect the buildings. But even if they were to erect two or three, the average self-storage facility is somewhere in the 50,000 square foot range during your hold period, it's very likely that you can still implement your value add strategy, raise rents aggressively. But then kind of to compound that, because of the fact that it's easy to build them, and what I mean it's easy to build them, and Edwin, what you also mean by that is that basically the replacement cost is usually cheaper than you can buy them for, which is rare in real estate. You hear, generally speaking, people advertise that you're buying properties cheaper than the replacement cost. Well, in self-storage, you know, just to be transparent, that's usually not the case because you're not really building all of that much. But there are many markets, you know, particularly in the Southeast, where there's memorandums against building new self-storage facilities within certain counties or geographic locations.
That's kind of like the mobile home park type issue. I mean, you know,
exactly.
Very few city planners want another mobile home park in their community. I get it. Okay, so where's the sweet spot for investors? Because obviously there's a lot of big corporate players. There are some mom and pops out there, varying sizes of units, varying amenities, if you will, if self-storage even has amenities, but you know, a little bit. Speak to that, if you would.
Sure. So, you know, I think that right now in particular, it's really important to play in an area that you have the ability to get consistent deal flow. And so I have found that the self-storage asset class provides this from a big picture perspective because the purchase prices generally range from about $3.5 million to $15 million. And that's where I think it makes sense to invest in the asset class. This is generally a little bit too large for most mom and pop accredited investors to take down or really significantly move the needle. But also, more importantly, it is too small to have, if you're having, you know, if you're Blackstone and you have a $100 million fund and you're using 3-to-1 leverage, you're talking about $300 million worth of real estate. It's going to be very challenging for you to allocate all of that towards self-storage. By the nature of the purchase prices, they just simply don't get up into that $40, $50 million range.
These big institutional investors have been buying single-family homes like crazy, so I don't know.
Yeah, certainly. I'd say that, generally speaking, we just haven't really seen the same kind of interest in the space, particularly in the tertiary markets. And so those markets can provide significant cash flow. And I think one thing that we haven't touched on yet is really the reason that, kind of similarly to some of the other asset classes out there, self-storage is incredibly complicated business. It's much more like a business than a commercial real estate asset. So you have to have a system in place in order to effectively run these properties. It does sound like it's simple. You're just basically keeping someone's stuff. But there is so many line items that can be tweaked and bettered to make the property run efficiently. So you're talking about things like online marketing, SEO, building relationships with nearby businesses or truck rental companies, management protocols, branded merchandise. All of these things really start to add up, and you can add significant value to the property by just simply implementing these strategies and not really going through the capital expenditure risk. So this is the reason why you may see public storage buying in Los Angeles and San Francisco, but you're not seeing them buy in Fayetteville, North Carolina, for example.
Okay, good. So how would an investor listening to this, Hunter, how would they attack this market? I mean, do they have to go in on a syndication deal, or are there opportunities for them to just go out and find properties and buy them?
Yeah, I think that's something that it's a lot of that has to do with your personality, right? So if you are an investor and you are interested in controlling the asset, then the passive investment syndication model is probably not for you. It's just not going to be the kind of investment that's going to suit your personality, and there's no reason fighting that. I have always been on the argument that investing in passive syndications, particularly those managed by top 50 sponsors and top 50 in the US, for example, especially if it's a complicated asset class like self-storage, I think sponsors will more than make up for their promote in exchange for that time, energy, expertise, access
their
to capital,
promote,
and liberty.
What does their promote mean? That means their fee?
Yeah, exactly. Okay. So in a typical syndication, typical structure would be something to the effect of a 8% preferred return or a split thereafter.
Right.
So investors are entitled to a return. And the promote is generally that waterfall there that I just kind of described.
Okay, basically 8% will go to the investors as a pref. But then what's the split after that? Like on your deals as a, well, you are a sponsor in some of your deals, right? You also work with other sponsors?
Yeah. And with, when it comes to us, you know, we've done a variety of different things. But, you know, just to give you an understanding of the general structure, there's usually a preferred return, which is somewhere in the tune of, you know, 6 to 12%, depending on the experience level of the sponsor. And then thereafter, there's a split, usually somewhere between 50% to 80% going to the sponsor. And that is usually based on the amount of duties required for that particular property. So if it's simply just a buy and hold core asset where you're not really adding a lot of value, the split would be appropriate in the 80% or 70% going to investors. And as you get more into development and adding significant value and the track record of the sponsor is more pronounced, they obviously have a more favorable split at that time.
Okay. So on your deals then, are you putting in money into the deals or are you strictly taking equity for services, you know, finding the deal and setting it all up?
Yeah. So I personally invest in each opportunity we have. The business was really founded based on, you know, my perspective as an investor. So I built relationships up with sponsors and, you know, created infrastructure in terms of conducting due diligence and running background checks and criminal checks and really going through the entire underwriting process myself, and then built a business around those relationships and that infrastructure. And so I do invest in each opportunity, and that's the whole point. I would never, you know, help investors invest in an opportunity that I didn't feel comfortable investing in myself.
Okay, so you put money into the deal, but that's, are you buying the equity at the same price the investors are? Or, I mean, you're getting some equity just for setting it up and finding it and doing all that due diligence work, right? You've got it.
Yeah, I am. And it depends on the transaction, which how in which that compensation is granted. So in sometimes, because of the fact that we invest significantly, you know, usually to the tune of a million or more, we can get more favorable returns for investors. And then we can sometimes be compensated by the sponsor. And then in other times, for a variety of reasons, we may create an entity and our compensation will be to the tune of, let's say, 2 to 3% on an annualized basis based on performance. And I think that'll kind of give you a spectrum of what we've done in the past.
Okay. All right, good. What else do you want people to know, Hunter?
I'd say that, you know, I think you really touched on it early on, which is that the supply demand equilibrium is really key. But once you have that problem solved, and once your due diligence results in you being able to wrap your head around the supply demand equilibrium, there's such an opportunity to add significant value to these properties. I mean, I've invested in properties where U-Haul alone can make a big difference on the value of the property. So this is a strategy where, you know, we leverage a pre-existing relationship with U-Haul, allow U-Haul to park their trucks on the facility, and then rent out those trucks to the tenant base and get a commission from U-Haul for facilitating the transaction. I have personally invested in properties where that one line item, the previous owner wasn't implementing it at all. So it went from $0 a month to $3,800 a month within 12 months. And if you compound that with, let's say, mandatory tenant insurance, again, completely not implementing that to implementing that, they can add another, let's say, $2,000 per month. If you add those numbers up together and multiply them by 12 and divide them by a 7 cap, which would be conservative, I mean, you're talking about $1 million of value you can add to a property. But that's on a risk-adjusted basis, really favorable. There's no capital expenditure in what I just explained. You're not buying the trucks. You're not actually maintaining the trucks. It's just leveraging that relationship. And I think that that's where the key is of the asset class going forward. I don't think it's necessary to bring on those additional risks to a massive extent in order to achieve, you know, lucrative returns for investors.
Does U-Haul have a plentiful opportunity? I mean, U-Haul has their own storage facilities, not everywhere. Some of them, they're just doing a deal with a gas station. I mean, listen, I've dropped U-Haul trucks off at gas stations and so forth. Sometimes it might be another storage unit, but are they really in need of that type of thing? Or do they pretty much have their issues with their trucks covered? I mean, they're a giant company. They've been around forever.
Yes. And they certainly do have a very proficient self-storage arm as well. But the relationship with U-Haul is symbiotic in the sense that not only does it help U-Haul obviously rent those trucks, it also is going to help the self-storage facilities. So the trucks are there. U-Haul owns the trucks. If they're not getting leased out, they're very, very, very happy to supply self-storage operators with that capacity.
Right, but because, again, my question is, do they already have that covered? I mean, there are U-Haul locations all over the place, whether they be deals like the one you're describing or their own centers or gas stations or whatever, right? You know, that's
yeah, so yeah.
I understand it's symbiotic. I get it.
Sure. So I think it's really about providing the customer access on site. And I think that the convenience of that is really beneficial. So we've never had a problem getting access to trucks. I mean, there are facilities that I've invested in that are literally full. There's 40 U-Haul trucks there, and there's always 40 U-Haul trucks there, and they're always being rented out. So, I mean, it's not something that we struggle with in the past, for sure.
Okay, good, good. Do you have any storage units, or are you planning to have any, that are automated? Or do they all still require an on-site person, many times that lives there, an on-site resident manager? How do you handle that?
Yeah, it's a good question. This is something that's coming up a lot. I just wrote an article about it, and I think that it's definitely something that's happening in the business. Right now, and this is just my perspective, it's a little preliminary to make the call as to whether it's a good trade-off or not. I know there's a couple of companies that are doing it very successfully. I think some of that success is probably because of the fact that they're able to buy these mom and pop operators, and just the fact that they're thinking of it as a business. Not only just the automation component is really helping them a lot, but the drawaway or the takeaway potentially, or the potential trade-off, I should say, is that having an on-site manager there allows you to really upsell clients in terms of those things like mandatory tenant insurance, U-Haul, getting climate controlled units, getting drive up units. All of that is something that it can be automated by a kiosk. And I would be shocked if that doesn't take place later down the road. But right now, it's not 100% proven. I mean, even the U-Haul thing, that alone can pay for the salary of a property manager. So until the kiosk can adequately sell those products, I think it's too early right now.
So we're not at the automation point yet on self-storage then, right?
It's certainly taking place. People are trying it out. I think the other thing that kind of comes up is there's apps right now, and there's places like MakeSplace and Clutter where they basically come to your home. It's on-demand self-storage. So they come to your home, they pick up your self-storage, they drive it away to a warehouse that's like 45 minutes away usually, and they store your property there. And because of the fact that, if you're driving from, let's say, Manhattan to 45 minutes away from Manhattan, it's so much less expensive to store stuff in that warehouse that they can offer the product basically for the same price, it's on demand. It's incredible.
Well, that's what Pods does. I mean, that's kind of the Pods philosophy, isn't it?
Exactly. And, it's an on-demand storage. People are basically using an app to do it. The challenge, though, or I guess my thesis regarding that is this is one of many reasons why we focus on tertiary markets. Because if you're driving from, like I said, let's say Charlotte, North Carolina, to 45 minutes outside of Charlotte, North Carolina, or even Fayetteville, North Carolina, to 45 minutes outside of that, whatever that is, the differential between rental rates is not significant enough to validate the business model.
Right.
So I'm not worried really about that. But San Francisco, Los Angeles, public storage, which has purchased a lot of properties in hyper-prime markets and hyper-prime neighborhoods, they're going to experience some price depreciation if they can't offer a similar comparable product.
Mm-hmm. So with the truck concept that you mentioned, would that make for a less sticky tenant base, though? It would concern me that, I mean, I guess you're probably going to say that the truck only goes one way. It only does pickups, never brings your stuff back to you.
We do have some sponsors that will do free truck rentals on move in, not move out. But generally speaking, the headache that goes along with move, I mean, it's really, if you look at the list of most stressful things that a person can go through, it's moving, always up there. Right. And so, that's something that people don't want to do. The saying is, you see a self-storage facility twice, right? And some people only see it once. For real. They move in and that's the last time they come. And so this is something that's taken place many, many times. So, to answer your question directly, not something that we've struggled with in the past.
Yeah, good stuff. Well, underwriting, vetting a deal, finding a deal. Talk to us about that a little bit.
Sure. So, with any important investment opportunity, when it comes to underwriting, it's always important to be conservative. We usually find deals that are, right now we're looking at about buying at 6 caps. And that can be a little bit misleading because of kind of the strategy I was talking about earlier. Because of the fact that you have a sticky tenant base that's in monthly leases, you can raise rents aggressively. There's a lot of fragmentation in the business. There's not a lot of transparency. So properties can be significantly under market rent. You can raise them quickly and you can implement those strategies. And that 6 cap may turn to a 7.5 cap pretty quickly. As far as the overall returns of the property, we're looking at increasing rents by 6% a year for the first 2 years or so until they get up to market rates. from there, 4%, 3%, something in that range, and being very close to lockstep with inflation expenses. And then exiting, you know, usually at a 7 cap, depending on the marketplace, or 6.5 cap.
Okay, so that's back to that question I think I asked you earlier about hold time. Did you want to address that, or did you then? There a certain sort of target hold time?
We usually talk, based on what we're seeing, I'd say that 7 to 10 years is an appropriate hold time, and that's a conservative hold time. I think that that's something it's really important to be conservative on. People need their money when they think they're going to get it back. And I think that, you know, implementing those strategies and selling during favorable market conditions, which is obviously really critical, is totally possible within that time period. There are properties that we purchased in 2014 that were just sold last month with a 7 to 10 year time horizon. You know, we're happy to turn investor capital earlier, not so happy to turn investor capital later.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, good stuff. Okay, so finding and vetting deals.
Yeah, so a lot of the deal flow, this is why I partner with sponsors. So they're on the side of, you know, actually having the relationship with brokers, sending out mailers, just being known in the industry results in a lot of off-market transactions. And so a sponsor will bring in a deal to me. I will usually go through and look at some of the most important factors, which are, you know, the supply-demand disequilibrium, the daily traveled vehicles per day, the median household income, et cetera. But a lot of the deal flow is going to come from the sponsors.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so the sponsors are strictly your connections, your relationships in the industry. Are they also syndicating or running funds, or are they simply bringing it to you and saying, raise capital for me?
It's deal dependent, but generally speaking, I like to work with sponsors that have a significant track record that don't have a lot of problems raising capital. So most of them don't work with individual investors that are investing 25 or 50 or even 100,000 and are looking for minimums of a million or more. That's not always the case. We've definitely partnered with sponsors that are raising their own fund, but usually they're looking for family offices, high net worth individuals, et cetera. And that's kind of where the value add is in the company as a whole.
How long does it take to vet a deal? How many sort of man hours does it take to do that?
Well, you know, it starts from, you know, on my end, it starts from receiving many, many, many deals per year and throwing the vast majority of them in the trash because they don't meet the criteria for a variety of reasons, including risk profile. Goes through the entire underwriting process and the entire market due diligence process and ends with, you know, an on-site property visit. Usually this can be accomplished in somewhere between 30 and 60 days total. And that's while the property is already under purchase and sale agreement by the sponsor.
Good, good stuff. So is it just you vetting, though? I mean, I find that it takes a long time to vet commercial deals. I mean, the mobile home park that I own with a client and apartment complexes, you know, these things are complicated. It really requires a lot of thinking. Like, you have to ask yourself, you know, what are they hiding? What are they not showing me here? What am I not seeing? Because that can really burn you later, you know?
Totally. And I'd say that the main thing that I think can paint a really clear picture, at least really, really help you along the way, is looking at the T3, T12, trailing 12-month, trailing 3-month financials. If you're looking through, you know, these financials and going through line by line item, you're going to notice things like physical occupancy. You're going to notice any disparities if they're playing funny numbers with the, if they're making any kind of concessions that are going to result in the higher occupancy, or if they're actually trying to inflate rent, or if you're seeing weird things like in the self-storage business, you may see something where they're allowing tenants to pay at any time during the month. So tenants will come in and pay on the 4th and give them $20, and they'll come in on the 12th and give them $100.
What a mess.
And we have seen that. So when you buy a property like that, you got to be aware that that's going to be a complete headache when you're trying to get that tenant base, which has been doing that for the last 25 years, into paying. And if they don't pay, they're getting a late fee. That's something you have to be cautious of. But to answer your question, I think a lot of those major problems can be handled by looking at the trailing financials. And then, of course, you know, going through the entire, you know, rest of the due diligence process, which includes the environmental stuff as well.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Okay. Interesting. Good stuff. Well, Hunter, this has been very insightful and educational. What else do you want people to know? I know I asked you that question before, but I just want to make sure you get anything out there that maybe is a question I haven't asked, some of your favorite books on the subject or educational resources where people can learn more, anything.
Yeah, sure. Well, I mean, first of all, this is definitely really detail oriented. I'm really glad we got to have this conversation. So hopefully your listeners were, you know, enjoyed it. And this is an asset class that not a lot of people are talking about right now. But I think that a lot of people are getting interested in it just because of where we are in the cycle. Generally speaking, I think if you're listening to this podcast, you're right in the right track. If you're focused on real estate education, you know, like he mentioned earlier, this is the best way to build wealth. And I think diversification is key. You mentioned a couple of books. I wrote a short ebook, probably takes about 35 minutes to read. It's available on my website. It's the Little Boxes Big Profits. And if you send me an email at hunterthompson@cashflowconnections.com, I'd be happy to give you a free copy. Mm-hmm. And that'll kind of get you started on the asset class, where I think the opportunity is.
Good stuff. Hunter Thompson, happy investing. Thank you for sharing.
Thanks again. Really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for listening. Please be sure to subscribe so that you don't miss any episodes. Be sure to check out the show's specific website and our general website, hartmanmedia.com, for appropriate disclaimers and terms of service. Remember that guest opinions are their own. And if you require specific legal or tax advice or advice in any other specialized area, please consult an appropriate professional. And we also very much appreciate you reviewing the show. Please go to iTunes or Stitcher Radio or whatever platform you're using and write a review for the show. We would very much appreciate that. And be sure to make it official and subscribe so you do not miss any episodes. We look forward to seeing you on the next episode.